Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, now the Buddha has been, if you haven't copied this, I suggest a copy. Okay, now we've been studying the 46th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Maha Dhamma Samadana Sutta, the great or longer discourse on the ways of undertaking things. And in this sutta, the Buddha is explaining four different ways of life. And now, the first of these is a way that is painful now and ripens in future pain. Here on page 411. I know I explained this last time, but just to review this part before we go ahead, I review it. Okay, so the first two ways of life are determined by engaging in the ten courses of unwholesome kamma. Now the Buddha, one of the special faculties of the Buddha, faculties of wisdom, is called the knowledge of the paths going in all directions. Called Sapatagamini Jnana. So the Buddha knows the ways of conduct, ways of life that lead to all the different realms of existence. This is one of those knowledges that enables him to fulfill the function of a Buddha. The Buddha doesn't have the function only of showing the way to enlightenment, only of showing the way to liberation. But the Buddha, in order to really be able to benefit sentient beings, has to be able to teach sentient beings in accordance with their dispositions, different dispositions and faculties of understanding. And thus, to complete that function, the Buddha is able to understand what ways of conduct lead to rebirth in the lower realms, and what ways of conduct lead to rebirth in the human realm, what ways of conduct lead to rebirth in the higher realms, the heavenly realms. And then in addition, he also knows the ways of conduct that leads out of the cycle of rebirths, out of samsara, to nirvana. And so now in this sutta, the Buddha is showing the contrast between the ways that lead into the lower realms and the ways that lead to the higher realms. And as is typical for the Buddha, he generally begins, almost invariably begins, by showing the negative side of the teaching first before presenting the bright or positive side. So here we have the ways that lead to the lower realms, and these all revolve around these 10 courses, 10 pathways of unwholesome karma. And the Buddha teaches these as a way of warning. It's like if you're traveling past, and say, an electric power plant, there will be a barbed wire fence around it, or maybe a plant where they're testing very powerful secret weapons. There'll be a barbed wire fence around it with sign, dangerous, keep out, do not enter. and guards standing by the gates to check the ID of anybody who wants to enter, to make sure that they are entitled to enter. So the Buddha first, now he puts up sort of warning signs. These ways should be avoided because they lead to undesirable results. And so we have these 10 courses of unwholesome action, which are classified according to the door of, we call the door of action through which they originate. We have three basic faculties of action. And in the Buddhist technical terminology, they're called dwara, which it's related etymologically to the English word door. And why are they called door? A door is a passageway through which you go from inside a building to the outside of the building, right? And so in our relation to the world, we have the inside, what goes on in our minds, and the outside, the world in which we exist. And there are three doors through which what goes on deep inside the mind exits out into the world. Actually, it's only two of the three doors in which the things that go on deep in the mind really get out into the world. The third door, the mind door, maybe it's like inner passageway by which what goes on deep in the mind comes up to the surface of the mind. So the first coarsest door is the body door. Second door is the speech door. The third door, the inside door, is the mind door. And what goes out through the doors is basically our intentions, volitions, states of mind. And we give expression to these states of mind either by acting in certain ways, by performing deeds, by speaking in certain ways, or else just by entertaining thoughts, constructing, giving ways to thought constructions, indulging in thoughts, building up thought formations through repeated entertaining of these thoughts. And these thought constructions that we build up again and again act as kind of channels through which we interpret what comes in through the doors of the senses. This is another sense of the word door. We have three doors of action by which what goes outside, by which what goes on inside spills out to the outside. And we have six doors by which what goes on outside comes inside. What are those six doors? Yeah. Yeah. Right. These are the six doors of the senses. The Pali also uses the word dwara. Okay, so through the body door, when one takes an unwholesome tract, then those unwholesome thoughts, unwholesome volitions, that is the key word here, volitions or intentions. It's good to know the Pali word chetana. So when there's unwholesome chetana, say violent, angry thoughts, those thoughts can break out in the form of destructive behavior, hurting others physically, abusing them physically through physical violence, and in the strongest case, leading to killing, the destruction of life. Other times, greedy thoughts take possession of the mind. Possessive thoughts. And those thoughts will express themselves in the physical deed of stealing or in any other, some other way, misappropriating the belongings of others. Taking what is not given. Then, if lustful thoughts dominate the mind, then it can, those thoughts can break out in the form of sexual misconduct, engaging in sexual relations with what's called an illicit partner. So these are three primary ways of, in which unwholesome thoughts and volitions express themselves in bodily action. Then even though the tongue is much smaller than the body, just a little fraction of the body, but the tongue gets four types of unwholesome action because the tongue speech is capable of a wider variety of types of action, even than the body. So if you really reflect upon this, you see how much of our world, of our experience, is constituted by our communications with others, what we express to others, and the way we absorb and react to communications that others impart to us. Seems to me that it might be, of course, it's difficult to put percentages around these things, but about 70-80% of our significant activity focuses upon communication rather than on actual bodily physical action. And so through speech, one can break the limits of proper conduct through false speech. We conventionally call lying, misrepresenting facts, and generally to be a course of karma, it should be a type of lying which is motivated by either a desire to harm others or to, in some tricky, deceptive way, to gain benefits for oneself. Then there's malicious speech, which is uttering words intended to break up the friendship or harmonious relations between those who are friendly with each other. Then there's angry speech, harsh speech, speech which is said to cut into the feelings of others. And then there's just idle chatter or gossip. Okay, so those four types of actions, those are expressions through the door of speech. Then there are three types of mental, purely mental unwholesome karma. These are called, one is called covetousness. It's not a common word in English. I don't even know if it will be found in the dictionary because it's an abstraction from the adjective covetous. But it means, let's say it's greed, which is intent upon gaining the possession of the possession of somebody else for oneself. It's not simple greed, not just a desire to possess things or to enjoy some indulgent pleasure, but it's the desire, the wish that what belongs to somebody else will somehow become one's own. So it's a kind of fantasy that in some cases it might lead to stealing, but in many cases it doesn't have to. But even if it just remains without expressing itself as the act of theft, it's still an unwholesome course of action. But covetousness arises from greed, That is, the unwholesome root is greed. Or as even you could call it, it's a kind of greed, but a very, very strong greed with illicit or illegal purposes in view. Then the ninth is ill will. This is a kind of hatred, but it's the hatred which reaches such dimensions that one actually starts wishing that other beings, other people, would undergo some real injury or even death. It's a desire for harm to come to others. It doesn't reach the point where one is actually motivated to kill. Oh, and sure as heck wishes somebody else would do the act for one. And then the tenth course of unwholesome action is wrong view. But there are many, many types of wrong view, but the wrong view, which the Buddha classifies as an unwholesome karma, is the view that holds that there's no results of ethically significant action. That our karma, that our actions, our karma, will not bring results or fruits that in some way reflect the moral quality of our actions. This we could call a nihilistic view. The nihilistic view. If you remember when we discussed Sutta number 60, we came across variations of this view, that there's no benefit from giving charity, self-sacrifice, no point in serving one's parents, no need to respect ascetics who are living lives of simplicity and restraint, no good and bad results, no fruits of good and bad actions. Okay, now these types of actions, there are many, many types of unwholesome actions, but the Buddha has selected these 10. Well, for one thing, they form a nice set of 10. You could count them easily. But also, they have the special function in the process of rebirth, since it's these 10 actions which are called pathways of karma. And they're called pathways of karma because they are pathways which lead from one existence to another. They lead. At the time of death, the different actions that we perform in the course of life get somewhat juggled up. And as death comes closer and closer, one of these actions will take on the special function of generating rebirth. It gains power, increased power. It comes to the surface of the mind. Everything else that we've done constellates around us. And this action projects or propels the stream of consciousness into its new existence. And it is precisely these actions that take on that role. That is why they are called pathways of karma. And the Buddha says that the first way of undertaking things is that with pain and suffering, well, somebody in pain and grief kills living beings. The second way is that the way that is pleasant now and ripens in the future is pain. This is explained that someone in pleasure and joy kills living beings, and he experiences pleasure and joy as a result of killing living beings. Or that where he experiences pleasure and joy that have the killing of living beings as condition. So what this indicates is that even though the 10 courses of action is something which is the same, common to these two ways of life, some people engage in them almost unwillingly, or they have to undergo a lot of pain and suffering. Maybe these are people who have some deep compulsion to engage in unwholesome behavior, some deep compulsion in the mind so that it's unpleasant and disagreeable for them to do this. But for some reason, they just can't stop themselves. Perhaps there are people who are habitual killers, and they find themselves, they don't want to kill, but they just can't help it. Whereas other people find pleasure and joy in engaging in these actions. Can anybody think of any examples of people who will engage in such actions even while experiencing pain and displeasure? Any ideas? Yeah. Excuse me? That's a good idea, a good suggestion. Yeah, a soldier who might be drafted, say, into the army, and so he's terrified, but he's forced into battle, and so he's compelled to kill. And even if he's a person with a conscience, then he doesn't want to kill. But he could be conscripted, or else out of economic necessity, forced to take a job as a soldier. Actually, if we could think of any cases. Yeah. I don't have experience of that.
Not unusual.
Yeah.
Become angry, I'm not contented with my husband doing it.
Yeah.
And I knowing it brings me pain again, still complain and then
Now complaining is all right. Don't have to hesitate to complain. Just don't kill him. Yeah. 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 By complaining again and again. Bring him to the class.
I don't do that anymore.
Okay. Reverend.
Yeah, I think a lot of times when people work in companies,
yeah,
and companies are engaging in some kind of actions, yeah, that are not agreeable to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Unwholesome, which,
yeah,
thing is violating their ethics.
Yeah.
But being a part of that company,
right, yeah, yeah,
carry out that particular action because they constitute that particular screw, yeah, that whole machine.
Yeah.
And it's painful, yet they still have to do it.
Yeah. And that's a good example. Yeah. Okay, those who have to are compelled by their company to engage in some kind of ethically questionable action in order to, if you want to keep your job, you better do this. Right? Any other examples from daily life? Peter? Yeah, actually it's said that ill will, this is like we call the Abhidharmic analysis, the very fine microscopic analysis of mental states that's developed in Buddhism. Ill will, it's always immediately accompanied by displeasure or pain of mind. Covetousness, we would say, is that the state of mind leading up to covetousness will be a painful state of mind, and afterwards, but covetousness itself, actually it seems to me that one could have covetous thoughts with displeasure in the mind, because one is envying the possession of others. Yeah. So maybe that lack, sense of lack leading up to the covetous thoughts will be accompanied by pain. Jim in the back. Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a good example. Yeah, okay. Somebody has to lie. They have a drug habit. And so in order to satisfy that habit, they have to lie in order to cheat people out of money or else steal, compelled to steal. Okay, so these are things which are done with an unpleasant frame of mind. So they experience pain and suffering while engaging in these actions. Yeah, that could be the case, yeah. But then there are, the other cases of engaging in unwholesome action was, for some reason, unwholesome action tends to bring more pleasure and joy than pain and suffering. Well, people, they like to go, fishing, hunting, and they get the animal, they see the deer, shoot it, successful hit, enjoy. Or maybe there's the excitement of a bank robbery, great joy and thrills. You succeed in getting away with it. You're driving quickly and mind very ecstatic, blissful, particularly if they steal a lot of money and then divide it up. They're very joyful and happy. Then, of course, the sexual misconduct, somebody who goes around, say, seducing a lot of women, married women, then he's enjoying himself. And maybe somebody who likes telling tall tales, lies to bolster his own ego, so he enjoys this. He likes the when he sees others buy his line, buy his false stories, then he starts swelling with pride, and he not only because he's built up his image in the eyes of the others, but in his own eye he thinks that he's so much cleverer than the others since he could deceive them. Okay, so we have these two courses, one accompanied by pain, the other accompanied by pleasure, but even that pleasure endures only temporarily. Because when the body breaks up and death takes place, then both of them, if these unwholesome actions take control of the mind at the time of death, then they are reborn in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. I should explain these terms a little bit. Not very popular these days, except maybe amongst the Christian preachers. But we have to mention it. These are called, in in Buddhism, apaya, that's translated here as deprivation. It means states which are deprived of happiness. They're sometimes also called dukkati, that's translated here unhappy destination. Gati means gone, going. Du is bad, so it's the bad destination. And vinipata means literally throwing down. So it's called perdition or downfall, a state of downfall. And these are three unhappy destinations. One is the hells, another is the animal world, and the third is the realm of the spirits, or sometimes they call them hungry ghosts. These are beings that have very strong desires, but they can never satisfy it. So what are the pathways, the highways, that lead into those unhappy realms of existence? Those pathways, there are 10 pathways leading into them, which are just these 10 unwholesome courses of karma. Don't think that this is just fairy tale or mythology or legend. These are really true. I mean, this is repeated by the Buddha over and over again. And it's not the work of some later compilers of the canon. They're mentioned just too often for us to accept that. Okay, now the other side of the teaching is the bright side of the teaching. These are the 10 wholesome courses of action, which are just the opposite of the 10 unwholesome courses. Here I have them on the sheets that I gave out. First, abstaining from killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Okay, now what changes these unwholesome actions into wholesome actions is that one forms one deliberately forms an intention to abstain from these unwholesome courses of action. It's not enough that just by chance one doesn't engage in them. So of course, it might be somebody has naturally such a pure and good character that he or she is not tempted into these unwholesome types of action. But when we start off on our training to really make ourselves safe and secure, we have to form the intention, the resolution, to refrain from these actions. And this intention of refraining, of abstaining, transforms the unwholesome actions into wholesome actions, or rather, we could say the intention of abstaining in each case replaces the unwholesome action with a corresponding type, an opposite type of wholesome action. And so, especially when one is undertaking the observance of morality in Buddhism, we make the determination to follow the 5 precepts. We take a precept to refrain from the destruction of life. That determination, it doesn't mean merely that one is stopping the destruction of life, but that determination itself is a very powerful, wholesome type of karma. which is now, on the one hand, say the preventive function, it's checking the unwholesome action of killing, but it's also lodging itself in the mind as a positive, purifying, wholesome quality. Similarly, we undertake the precept to abstain from taking what is not given, to abstain from sexual misconduct, to abstain from false speech. So these types of abstinence is not merely the negative refraining, but it's a positive mental factor of gaining possession of one's own mind. Through intention, one is now reining in, checking the unwholesome dispositions or habitual tendencies of the mind, and replacing them with some determination, resolution, that indicates one is now going to be the master of one's own mind. And if one wants to go further with the training, even though we don't have precepts to this effect, but you also determine to refrain from malicious speech, from saying things which divide people, the determination to refrain from harsh or angry speech, determination to refrain from empty chatter or gossip. So these are seven types of abstinence, and they form also certain positive factors of the practice. We call one right action, the other right speech. They come in the Noble Eightfold Path.
So these three become right action,
these four right speech. Then the other three are not matters of abstinence. It's not that you make a determination to abstain from certain states, but rather you try to develop more directly positive qualities of mind to replace the unwholesome qualities. These positive qualities, one is, it's usually expressed negatively, non-covetousness. That is, one doesn't cherish longing or desire to get the possessions of others, but instead one tries to generate the attitude of contentment with what one has. So it doesn't mean that one has to be completely content. If one is living, say, a life as a businessman, one has to, one is directing one's business, one should direct it so that the business is successful and maybe can expand into new areas and develop. If you just remain completely content, then you just sit in the office and everybody takes advantage of you and buys you out, and you don't have any means of earning a living. So it's not a passive type of contentment, but you don't want to take any type of aggressive, domineering measures to gain possession of the belongings of others. No hostile takeovers. Then in place of ill will directed towards other beings, you develop goodwill, wishing that others will be, other living beings will be well and happy. And then in place of wrong view, the wrong view which denies the karmic effectiveness of action, you develop right view, and you hold very firmly to right view, the right view that actions do produce results, that there is some basic ethical significance, some deeper significance to our ethical actions. I like to think of it that when one engages in unwholesome actions, that the universe itself is saying boo, boo, boo. It's, what do they call that when you say booing the action? And the way it expresses its disapproval is by ensuring that those unwholesome actions bring unfavorable results. And when one engages in wholesome action, the universe is applauding or cheering. And the way it expresses its cheers or applause is by ensuring through the working of the karmic law that these wholesome actions bring happiness and well-being. Okay, so there are these 10 types of wholesome action, and those can be engaged in, again, either with a painful frame of mind. Let's see the order. This is number 3, the way of undertaking things that is painful now, but ripens in the future as pleasure. The other is the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. So this way, it's painful now, the third way, because someone with pain and grief abstains from killing living beings. And he experiences pain and grief that have abstention from killing living beings as condition. And similarly with the other 9 courses. Can we think of examples of this? Yeah. Well, maybe that's an analogy. But let's take something more literally. Any ideas?
Staying in meditation, you cross your legs,
yeah,
and it's painful.
Yeah.
And you just want to,
yeah,
uncross your legs. But
again, that's a good example, but let's take with regard to the 10 courses of action.
Yeah. The water sometimes kill animals.
Yeah, but now we're talking about abstaining from.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but in that case, he's not actually stopping.
I think you're talking about changing your restaurant from a meat restaurant into a vegetarian restaurant. That's painful. I've seen people change.
Yeah.
And then they lose a lot of business.
Yeah.
But in the end, they gain more business.
Yeah.
They branch into the vegetarian,
yeah,
market.
Yeah.
During the process, it's very painful.
Yeah. Okay, that's, again, it's somewhat more an analogy than a literal. Yeah. Yeah, though I think in this case, the case of disciplining a child, let me just think. This is not, it's not actually a case, that's a case that's a case of what would normally be a unwholesome action, like speaking harshly but with a good intent. Here we're taking cases of wholesome action which are accompanied by pain. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's a good example. Let's just take the first case of killing. Yeah.
You would want to seek retribution and you want to maybe do the same.
And
then there's the pain that you not go after that, whoever it was.
Okay, that's a good example. We have to take it, to make it more specific, that somebody, even though they're tempted to get revenge, but they recognize that this is wrong, and so they're refraining from doing it. I mean, that's an example, though it doesn't relate, it's not something that's on the list of 10 here. I want to take cases that are actually on the list of 10.
Stranded in a deserted island.
Well,
and then needs to kill, there's no vegetation.
Yeah.
He needs to kill in order to survive.
Yeah.
However, he does not kill because he knows that that's unwholesome.
Yeah.
But he starves, even starves to death.
Yeah.
And therefore, the rewards is pleasurable, but yet...
So that's a rather, again, that's a rather extreme example.
But it does happen.
I mean, how can we know if a person is on a desert island and starves to death through not killing?
Tell the story afterwards.
But if he starves to death, how does he tell the story?
Wouldn't the living things have starved to death as well?
Yeah. Okay, I would think of an example. Okay, somebody has been maybe a sportsman who goes hunting regularly, and he enjoys hunting. Then maybe he meets Buddhism. He first decides maybe he just wants to learn meditation to help himself get like a more accurate aim. Then he starts trying to meditate, and he starts finding that it's difficult, and he's maybe in the course of the meditation, he gets some exposure to Buddhist teachings, then decides he really wants to follow the Dhamma. And so he has to give up this hobby of hunting. And then the hunting season comes, all his friends go hunting, they say, won't you come join us? It's really painful for him on maybe Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon. He and all his friends go out. He's decided not to go. And so just that refraining, a decision to refrain, is painful. Again, somebody maybe is living in poor conditions and he's used to maybe pilfering the belongings of others, maybe at work. When the boss isn't looking, he'll swipe some belongings of the company, even if it's an open cash register, reach in, take out a few dollars, or cheat the company when doing the books. Then he decides that he wants to, somehow he meets these ethical teachings, that he wants to follow the precepts, and then decides, now I will refrain from taking what doesn't belong to me. And so even though he has to live in difficult conditions, live maybe he's a poor person, but he'll remain firm in that determination not to steal. Again, somebody might be called a philanderer who goes around like he enjoys committing adultery, going with the wives of others. Then again, he wants to observe a wholesome way of life and makes that decision to abstain from sexual misconduct, then this will cause, again, when that desire arises, the lust arises, but he restrains it, then it becomes painful. But sometimes if we get angry, we become tempted to speak angrily. But now we make the decision, I'm not going to speak harshly to others. And so you put a brake on the mind not to speak harshly. So then you get angry, it's uncomfortable, but you hold firmly to that determination. So then you just watch the anger, it comes up, you don't speak, the anger remains in the mind, but then it gets a little weaker, 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 till it fades away. And so whenever one when we first start out on the Buddha's path, almost invariably it's difficult at the beginning. This is still a level basically of ethics or morality, but when one wants to practice meditation, Okay, one has to sit in a posture, somewhat uncomfortable, the legs are crossed, mind is wandering. Sometimes the mind's more than wandering, it's wild, romping and galloping and jumping here and there. One wants to get up, do something, become active. One is pushed, propelled, driven this way and that. But you just remain sitting firmly, sitting squarely, watching the mind, watching, let the thoughts rise, fall away, rise, fall away. In this way, gradually the mind settles down. But at first, it's a lot of struggle and difficult. But then somebody who has become, when you become habituated to wholesome action, then it's enjoyable and one experiences pleasure and happiness here and now. And in both cases, when these wholesome actions take on the role of generating rebirth, they will bring rebirth into the happy realms of existence. These are called sukhati. The two heavenly realms of the human realm and the heavenly world, the heavenly realms, of which there are many, many different layers. Okay, so this completes the four ways of undertaking things. And there are, of these four ways of undertaking things, there are two of these ways, are ways by which we can distinguish who is really the wise person and who is the foolish person. What are these two ways? Excuse me? Try, I guess. Yeah, the question is, two of these four ways, we call these the touch acid tests for distinguishing who is foolish and who is wise. What are those two ways? But now you're bringing in all four. What are the two for distinguishing the wise person from the foolish person?
Wholesome versus unwholesome.
You have to specify them by way of the four courses according to the names they're given in the sutta. Should be able to tell. Give a little thought to it. Say this again. Okay.
The unwise person yeah. takes the way one out and wise
person yeah.
And the wise takes the way that is painful now.
Yeah.
And wise person
people. Right. Okay. Good, good, good. Or I would put it this way, the wise person will avoid the way that is pleasant now and ripens in future pain. And again, the wise person will take the way that is painful now and ripens in future pleasure. Both of them, generally people want to avoid what is painful. So they'll both be temperamentally inclined to avoid what is painful now and ripens in future pain. Even though many people are still compelled by their addictions, by the force of habit, to do what's painful now and ripens in future pain. But when one thinks about it, both of them will avoid what is painful now. But the thing that's pleasant now, that is what attracts the foolish people. What is pleasant now and ripens in future pain. The foolish person doesn't think about his or her long-term well-being. But just even, you know, you see people, many people, they hear again and again, cigarette smoking causes cancer, cigarette smoking causes heart conditions. But the cigarette smoking still goes on. I'm surprised. Even young people, kids I see in the streets smoking cigarettes. This cigarette packets says cigarette smoker, well, actually the wording, through the pressure from the tobacco companies, the wording becomes so ambiguous and fluffy that sometimes you don't get, at least in this country, very clear, sharp warnings. But there are such warnings, and still people go on. They're addicted to taking a lot of sugar, eating fatty foods. People know that this will lead to heart conditions and strokes. But they... Excuse me?
The karma...
Yeah.
The karma that has been going on is that
sick. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so things that are pleasant, enjoyable, sugar-coated, attract, even though inside it brings painful results. And the things that are painful or difficult now, foolish people avoid. But a wise person who really reflects on what brings long-term well-being and happiness will take up what is difficult now, out of concern for one's well-being in the future. So we have to, when we're going to act, we have to really think quite carefully. Okay, and now the Buddha, very often he caps his teachings with similes. I think this is what we have now. It's one of the best, the ones that I like the best, and the Majjhima Nikaya. Quite a long one, to illustrate these four courses of action. We have first the example of a bitter gourd mixed with poison. And a man comes along who wants to live, doesn't want to die, who wants pleasure and is averse to pain. And he's given the warning. People tell him, this bitter gourd is mixed with poison. Drink of it if you want to, but you won't enjoy it. And after drinking it, you'll either die or you will experience deadly suffering. But even though he's given this warning, and even though the drink is terrible, but he's an addict. Or maybe he's very much afflicted with thirst. And so without giving any second thought, without any reflection, he just takes it up, drinks it. While he's drinking it, oh, it's terrible. And then after he drinks it, the drink goes, courses through his body, and then in a few hours he's dead. Or else he's becomes very seriously ill. So this is like the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. But in the second case, there is a cup with a drink possessing a nice color, very sweet smell, delicious taste, but it is mixed with poison. Then the man comes along. The people tell him, when you drink this, you'll enjoy it, but it's mixed with poison. And if you drink it, then the poison will take effect and you'll die or suffer deadly pain. But because he enjoys the smell and takes a little taste and likes it, so he drinks it and then he dies, comes to death or deadly suffering. This is like, say, an alcoholic who has been off alcohol for some time. Then a friend gives him, pours for him a shot of some high quality wine or Swiss or Scotch whiskey. And so when he smells, gets the smell of it and sees the color, it's very nice. But even though he might not die from one drink, but he knows that if he takes a drink, again, all of his resistance will break down and he'll again become an alcoholic. For somebody who has been a smoker, then gives up smoking, and then somebody comes with some high-quality cigarettes and offers them to him, he smells the cigarette, likes the smell of the tobacco, then lights up, and then before long he's addicted again. Okay, the third example we have fermented urine mixed with various medicines. But don't laugh. This refers to something which is said to have quite powerful medicinal qualities. What is done is to take, it's actually cow's urine, and into the cow's urine they place, it's a kind of nut or seed called, or a little fruit, a bitter fruit that's called myrobalan, Sri Lanka arulu, arulu haritaka in Pali. And this drink, it's not at all pleasant, of course, but it has very, very strong medicinal qualities. It could cure many, many ailments. I'm really trying to get into the American market. I don't think we've gotten a foothold yet in America, and I have connections back in Sri Lanka where they bottle the stuff. And so this is actually what the Buddha recommended to the monks. He said, if you don't get any other medicine, you just keep a bottle of the cow's urine with the artaloo. It's called putimuta, it's called. Puti is, means repulsive or fermented. Mutra is urine. That this is what the more ascetic monks in the time of Buddha used to use. They would just carry around a container with this small bottle of the fermented urine. And if they ever get sick, they just take some and it will dispel that illness. We will have a counter right by the exit, and if you want to buy a bottle. Okay, so we have this fermented urine, and it's mixed with various medicinal substances. And so a man comes who's sick with jaundice, hepatitis, and they say to him, they tell him that if you drink this, you won't like it, but you drink it, and you'll recover from your illness. And so the man takes the bottle, he might sniff it and think, oh, this is horrible. But then he thinks, I don't want this jaundice. And so he drinks it, and then very quickly he gets well. So that is like the way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. And then the fourth way is the way, okay, that there's this mixture of curd. Do you know what curd is? Actually, in India, they don't use bean curd, but this is the milk from buffalo. One could make it from cow's milk, too, but in Sri Lanka, at any rate, they use buffalo milk. It doesn't come like cheese. It's more like yogurt. Maybe even yogurt is a kind of curd. But it turns sour and thick in texture. And the buffalo curd is very, very delicious. Very nutritious, delicious. The fat content, it's pretty high, I guess. But considering that in countries like Sri Lanka, they don't have fatty meat, people will just eat generally fish. So it doesn't really do much damage to the health to get, in fact, they could use that fat. And they mix it with, in Sri Lanka, the buffalo curd they use, we call it treacle, ketopani. They call it honey when they speak English, but it's not honey from bees. It's the syrup that comes from a tree. A palm tree, kind of palm tree. It'd be in America, we would use maple syrup instead of this palm syrup. But here, this is madhu. Madhu is actually bees' honey. You can mix it with bees' honey as well. So you mix curd with bees' honey. Ghee, do you know what ghee is? Yeah. In India, it's quite common. It's like fatty parts of the butter are left behind, solid parts, so it's a pure like liquid from the butter, which is removed from the butter. The the solids are left behind, and one just takes this real oily substance called ghee. And molasses mixed together. It's about all of these mixed are supposed to have medicinal properties. Apparently it's a cure for dysentery. So if a man comes with dysentery and then they tell him, here is this mixture of these four substances, drink from it if you wish, and as you drink from it, you'll find that the color, smell, and taste are agreeable, and after drinking it, you will be well. And so the man drinks it, and he's enjoying it while he drinks it, and as a result, his dysentery disappears, and he regains his health. So that is like the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. And then the Buddha says, to conclude the sutta, he says, just as in autumn, in the last month of the rainy season, when the sky is clear and cloudless, the sun rises above the earth, dispelling all darkness from space with its shining and beaming and radiance. So too, the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure, dispels with its shining and beaming and radiance any other doctrines whatsoever of the ordinary, the common ascetics and Brahmins. Okay, and that is the end of the sutta. Any questions? Comments? Jim? Yeah. How does one, that's a good question. Okay, if one does a negative or unwholesome action, how does one reverse it? In a way, once one performs an action, one can't actually reverse that action itself. That action has been performed and it creates its karma. So that karmic potential is there. But we have to remember that karmas don't exist sort of sealed off from each other in a kind of void. But where they exist is in the mind. And so a karma is an action that's performed. It leaves a kind of potential deposit in the mind. But that potential is affected by all the other actions that we perform. And so, say, a negative karma, an unwholesome action, still has the capacity to ripen and produce its fruit. But if that karma is in a container with many, the container is the mind, with many other unwholesome actions, then those other unwholesome actions, they reinforce each other. So when an unwholesome action ripens, it becomes stronger, because it's powered by the other unwholesome actions. And so even a little unwholesome action can sometimes, when it ripens, be so strong it will bring much pain and suffering. But if one has performed an unwholesome action, even maybe many unwholesome actions in the past, but one's mind changes, one decides that one is going to follow the path of Dhamma, commit oneself to a wholesome way of life, then one performs many wholesome actions. Then one starts performing these wholesome actions and generating wholesome qualities of mind, and these all have the effect of weakening the unwholesome action. So the action is there, but when it brings its result, that result will be very weak, can be very weak. One can't actually transform the past action, but what one can do to weaken the force of the action, one thing is to experience regret for the action. Like in Buddhism, we don't encourage feelings of guilt in the sense of self-recrimination. I'm a sinner, I've been so terrible, so awful in my behavior. But one recognizes, yes, I have performed these actions, these are unwholesome actions, and I regret. And then one makes the determination, I'm not going to repeat these actions. So that conscious regret for the action, or feeling, we could say a feeling of remorse, plus the determination not to repeat the action, these are two powerful countermeasures which inhibit the action. They sort of like put up obstacles to the ripening of that action. And then one can engage in wholesome actions. For example, a person has been a thief, maybe stealing, maybe not a major thief, but a shoplifter, enjoyed stealing things in shops when nobody is looking. So now, maybe this happened years ago, so you can't return the articles, but you make a determination to counter the weight of those actions. I'm going to practice giving and generosity. And one resolves that these actions of generosity should counter the previous actions of stealing. Yeah, those actions that one has performed throughout one's past, they have the potential to ripen throughout one's future existences in samsara. Even there's the case the Buddha had two chief disciples. One was named Venerable Sariputta, the other was called Mahamoggallana. Venerable Mahamoggallana was the chief disciple with respect to Iddhi, which means psychic powers. He had the ability, if he wanted, to multiply his body so that it would turn into many bodies. He could appear, disappear, go through walls, mountains, fly through the air, go dive into the earth, visit different realms of existence. But many, many aeons ago, many aeons or many, many lives ago, long, long time, thousands of lives ago, he had killed his parents. And as a result of that action, that is one of the most terrible actions. It brings a rebirth in hell. So he had been reborn in hell as a result of that. Then somehow, at some later time, he became a follower of a previous Buddha. He accumulated merits and paramis, spiritual qualities over many, many lives, till he had all of the qualifications to become the second chief disciple of the Buddha. But that unwholesome karma of killing his parents hadn't yet fully exhausted itself. And so, in his final existence, a group of brigands. These were hired by one of the rival ascetic groups, spiritual groups, who were envious of the Buddha. They thought Moggallana was one of the... They wanted to weaken the Buddha's dispensation, but they realized that they couldn't attack the Buddha himself. So they sent some hired assassins to kill Moggallana. And when they came for Moggallana, he wasn't afraid of them because he was an arhant. He had completely destroyed all fear. But he wanted to spare them the unwholesome karma of attacking a chief disciple of the Buddha. But suddenly, though he tried to use his spiritual powers to get escape from the murderers, but his spiritual powers failed him. They were completely ineffective. And so then the murderers came for him, they beat him, stabbed him, and he died from that. So in that, excuse me? Reversed, yeah. I mean, it wasn't actually reversed, but that karma was exhausted. But it does happen that good actions will counter. That, in that case, the action with the karma was very, very strong, so he had to die because of it. But there was another disciple of the Buddha, another man in the time of Buddha named Angulimala, who was what we call him today a serial killer. He had lived in the forest, and he would stalk and kill people and cut off their fingers to make a garland. His name means finger garland. And so according to, well, I don't know whether this is legend or history, but it said that he killed 999 people. And everybody was afraid, frightened of him. But the Buddha realized that this Angulimala has the potential of sainthood in him, believe it or not. So the Buddha went into the forest, and Angulimala came after him, running with a knife to kill him. But the Buddha used his spiritual powers to work a kind of miraculous feat, so Angulimala couldn't even catch up to the Buddha. Then Angulimala threw down his knife, and then bowed down. He realized that this is the enlightened one himself who's come for me. So Angulimala threw down his knife, bowed down to the Buddha, and asked to become a monk. And the Buddha accepted Angulimala as a monk. And Angulimala shaved his head, put on the monk's robe, and became a member of the Buddha's retinue of disciples. But when Angulimala went on alms round, people saw him and recognized him, and they would refuse to give him food, threw things at him. And he came back to the Buddha. Some of the objects that they threw, stones and pieces of stones and rocks at him. He came back all black and blue with his head cut and bleeding. And the Buddha said to him, "Bear it, bear it. You are now suffering the pains that if you had not changed your way of life, you are now suffering from the karma that if you had not changed your way of life, that karma would have led you to rebirth in hell for many, many hundreds of years." So the way that karma came to fruition was just by being refused food and by being attacked by people, but nothing worse than that. Till eventually the Buddha convinced the people that Angulimala had now completely transformed himself, and then they came to respect him. So the way with the unwholesome action, another sutta gives a simile. I think I mentioned this last week. I did mention it recently. It's like taking a lump of salt. And if we have a bowl of water, we put the lump of salt into the bowl of water, then the water becomes very salty, right? So if you just take a sip of it, immediately you notice the salt. That's like the unwholesome karma in an undeveloped mind. When that karma comes to fruition, then it will produce strong results. But if we take a barrel of water and we put the lump of salt in and mix the lump so that it becomes diffused throughout the water, and then we take a sip of the water, you don't even taste the salt, or just very slight taste. That is like the unwholesome karma in a mind which has been changed, transformed, and is devoted to wholesome behavior, a wholesome way of life. All the wholesome karma, it's like beginning with a little bit of water at the bottom of the barrel. You put the lump of salt in, then you keep on filling the barrel of water, this one bucket after another of fresh water, till the salt gets so dissolved in fresh water that you can barely taste it anymore. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then it's quite late. So next week we come to Kukuravattika Sutta, the dog duty ascetic. Don't bring your dog to class next week. Okay, so to say thank you. Do I do that at the end of the class? Okay, we do the blessing, to share the merit. Eta vata cha amehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vata cha amehi sampadang punya sampadang.